For WFHB in Bloomington, this is Hereabouts,
a collaboration with the IU Asian Culture Center.
Hello, welcome to the feminism episode of Hereabouts Asian American Midwest Radio. I am your host for this episode, Joyce Lam. Today, we will feature fellow Hereabouts producer, Kayla Mation Garvin, who will be speaking on the topic in regards to her own work. Kayla, hello, welcome to the program again.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. It's so nice to be a guest this time.
Yeah. So why don't we start off by telling the audience, for those who don't know, who you are and what is your affiliation with Indiana University?
Great. I'm Kayla Mation Garvin. I am a second year playwriting MFA candidate here at Indiana University. So that means as a part of my candidacy for the MFA program, I also am an associate teacher here at the school, and I teach playwriting classes as well.
So, in light of this episode, we'll be talking about feminism. And I know that a lot of your plays have these political themes where you integrate them into the playwriting process. Could you tell us first about your work and how you infuse feminism into your work?
Yeah, definitely. So I have three plays out of about a dozen I've written that have entirely female casts. And on some level, that's just sort of a practicality thing. I hate to sort of generalize, but I do feel like I think this is true, that there are a lot of women working in theater who work extremely hard and don't often get opportunities. I also think that the existing canon of American theatrical works is very male-centered and very sort of, you know, it's a little bit old school. And yeah. I know that from my experience in working in theater, there are so many women working as actors, as directors, as designers, as producers who are not getting the credit they're due. So when I sit down to write a play, a lot of times I'm thinking about, okay, well, what am I interested in? And a lot of times I am interested in topics relating to feminism, but I'm also interested in this idea that playwriting is not only, you know, creating something for the stage, it's also creating jobs. And so who am I going to get those jobs too. And I really want to support women and non-binary people as much as possible. I also just am sort of interested in women's stories and non-binary people's stories because I think that's sort of like my lived experience. So that's the thing that I'm closest to. I mean, I feel like on some level it would be probably very instructive, actually, if I was to sit down and sort of write a male narrative and get into that mindset. But on the same moment, we have so many of those that already exist, and that's not really what I'm interested in promoting in the canon moving forward.
Yeah, that's so interesting that you're thinking so much about, for lack of a better word, the movement, and not only the content that you're producing, that you're creating, but also what it provides and what it means in feminism. Now I want to know, how were you first introduced to feminism, or rather, what made you passionate about the subject of matter?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like I've always sort of had an interest in topics that we would call feminist. I mean, every time I go home, my parents make me clean out the garage. I hope you're listening, Mom and Dad. But they make me clean out the garage because I still have boxes in there of all my like childhood things. And so on one of my trips home, I was cleaning out the garage and I found this book that I had written in second grade. It was for an assignment when it comes to writing, like a perfectionist/overachiever. So we were supposed to write this 7-page story about just sort of like a hero's journey, like a kid finds out they're special, like goes on a journey and, you know, gets the job done. And what I had written, and mind you, this was supposed to be 7 pages. I wrote a 32-page illustrated book about this princess who like gets told she's special and has to like save the world. And like the whole time she's just like walking around like, you think boys are better than girls? I'll show you. Like this stupid like thing I wrote when I was 7. I feel like looking back, you know, I've always sort of been like on the playground. I was sort of like, why can't I, you know, play sports with the boys? If a boy's going to be president of the school, I want to be president of the school. And I felt that pretty strongly from an early age, especially growing up with brothers and seeing how we are sort of like socialized differently. I feel like it's always been on my mind. you know, I think I first got introduced to sort of what we might call like white feminism. And I feel like the term white feminism gets a lot of people on edge, but it's a real thing. And when you look at the history of feminism and when you look at the history that we learn about feminism in schools or sort of like common knowledge of it, when we think about suffragettes, they actually were sort of like very opportunistic in the fact that they wanted the vote for essentially rich white women and nobody else. You know, they were not willing to promote suffrage for African American men or African American women. There's documentation that, you know, when they had organized marches and things, they would actually make black women march at the back of the line. They would segregate their own protests. And not because, you know, it's not, certainly there were state laws enforcing segregation at the time, but they're already sort of like breaking the law trying to get suffrage. Why not tear down everything that's wrong with the system instead of just what serves you? So I think I sort of had a second, third, fourth awakening to feminism as I got older and I started encountering particularly the work of black feminists like Angela Davis and Asada Shakur and, you know, also Asian American feminists like Grace Lee Boggs and Yuri Kochiyama. I think that sort of just broadened my worldview as to feminism being something that's not just for white women, not just for able-bodied women, not just for straight women. I feel like, too, there's a lot in feminism that, especially we're seeing now, this sort of wave of like trans-exclusionary feminism that's just like not okay. That's not feminism. I think feminism at its best, at its most ideal, promotes everyone's equality and not just women that are born into a certain situation.
It's so interesting when you talk about white feminism in the sense that it's helping a certain type of certain class of women. And it's so nice to hear that other representation is being considered when we talk about or when we consider the word feminism and what the word is meaning to not rather our generation, but what it means now and what this word is digressing into. This is Hereabouts. On this episode, we have Kayla Mation-Garvin, feminist and playwright, who is currently speaking about her work and how she integrates the theme of feminism into her plays. I just want to talk more about, I know that you're aware of this, you're very conscious of this, I've noticed, and I want to know if you integrate this into your work. You mentioned before that you integrate the theme of feminism into your work already, and as a feminist, how do you distinguish white feminism from what feminism really means, and how do you integrate that into your work?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. I feel like we're in this sort of like 2019 world where, you know, there's all this sort of performative wokeness going on. You know, you have to show everyone that you know what's up and that you're woke and that I'm speaking in second person, but I'm really speaking about myself. Like, I do feel like there's this need to like show that I'm woke, that I know what's going on and that I'm on the right side of everything. But I do think that sort of like wokeness has become sort of a joke almost, in that I feel like this idea of being woke or this idea of like having the right opinions about things according to the left is sort of faulty because it's a journey. And I feel like as long as we are acknowledging our mistakes and acknowledging that we're moving forward, we're in the right place. I do think that there are certainly definite distinctions to be made between white feminism and what I consider to be the feminism that I want to support. And usually that's just like Are we trying as hard as we can to get everyone in the room? How are we removing barriers so we can get everyone in the room? And are we constantly, constantly asking ourselves, like, okay, who's in the room? Who's speaking? Who doesn't get the chance to speak? How can we get more people in the door? And if they can't get in the door, how do we, like, make another structure so that everyone is here, you know? So I think that's sort of how I make that distinction when I'm just thinking about it by myself. But in terms of my work, my play, which opened this past week, which is, it's today's March 1st, House of Mirth is sort of about all of these issues. And sort of as an accident, House of Mirth is an adaptation of Edith Wharton's novel, The House of Mirth, which was written in 1905. It's about New York high society and about this girl who is born very privileged, but is not very wealthy. But, you know, she's born into this world of New York high society. That's all she knows. And so I was very interested in this work because I was interested in the main character and how she, in her own way, sort of code switches to prove that she's worthy, to prove that she's, like, worth her friend's time and ultimately worthy of marriage in the original novel. And so I was interested in that, how that related to my sort of experience as a mixed person, that having to constantly code switch and having to figure out when's the right time to call people out on stuff. Sometimes there is a right time to be quiet about it, and that's really hard for me. But yeah, so I adapted this novel in a very loose take where we're living in this world where white women have taken over, had a revolution, everyone's a woman in this world, they've gotten rid of all the men, but how is society still the same? And I think it's interesting because, you know, in talking with some of the audience members, I feel like people struggle with the idea that if women were given free rein over the world, that they would not that they would replicate some of these structures of oppression that we see in today's society. And, you know, I struggle with that too, but I do think at the same time, like, when we look at the history of what we call feminism, that's sort of what history points to, is that women are no more perfect than men. Even though I do think a lot of women have a different approach to things than men, a lot of people, you know, internalize the bullshit that we're taught. We're taught to believe certain things, especially, I think, around race. And this is a big, I think, a reason why this idea of white feminism is a problem, is that people take it really personally. Sorry, listeners. White women take it really personally being called a white feminist. And I think, for me, it's not about a person's inherent value if they're a white feminist. To me, when I see someone enacting the values of white feminism, it's not about them as a person. It's about what our society has taught us and what society has taught that person to do. Like, usually, I would say 9.95 times out of 10, it's just a person acting on how they're socialized and not acting out of malice or, like, a personal vendetta or personal racism, although that does happen. But I do think it's more about this idea that we're all born into this society, we're all sort of taught these messed up values, and there's sort of no escape from it. So as long as we're working towards equality and working towards equity and justice and representation and all of that, as long as we're working towards it, we're on the right track. And I don't think it's an individual problem. I really do think it's sort of a systemic, endemic problem that we're facing, in that everyone is sort of, like, socialized to believe in the idea of white supremacy. Oh, I feel like people are going to get mad about this interview. But no. I think it's true. Like, I don't think that we can deny, like, we live in a country in which 44 out of our 45 presidents have been, for all intents and purposes, as far as we know, straight white Judeo-Christian men, I think. I don't think it is a fallacy to say that we are indoctrinated with this idea that that's what is superior. And it's, you know, and we all know that to not be true.
When you speak of this quote-unquote wokeness, it's definitely a sense of self-awareness of your role in this society and what we're subjected to, and it could be discouraging. But now I'm wondering, these are views that I wouldn't say are, for lack of a better word,
these are unpopular views? Or they are popular?
Well, these views are, for the majority of people out there, they are whites, and of those who are feminists, they are also white. So I think these views are definitely in more of the minority, would you say?
Yeah, I think so, probably.
So my next concern is, have you ever been labeled as a radical or an extremist in your views because you're speaking for equal representation for all, or you're speaking for the minority? If so, how do you combat this, and how do you still remain resilient in your cause, and how do you persevere?
Yeah, I mean, that is a big thing. I do think that people want to call this viewpoint radical or extreme, but I think it's actually quite moderate. I think, you know, it's all about how we frame things. And if we frame normal, oh my gosh, I'm going to get mad. But if we frame normal as that it's okay to discriminate against trans people, against people of color, if it's okay to separate kids from their families, if that's normal for our government to do, of course, the point of view that everyone is equal and has inalienable rights is going to seem radical. If what we are allowing to go on in our society is so inhuman, for us to then say, okay, everyone has value. If you're sort of like of this train of thought, that sort of means that you have to reckon with the idea that, okay, so everyone has value. That also means, you know, people who hold these beliefs that I disagree with, they have value too. Like, Nazis have value, even though I think their viewpoint is just, what's the word?
Flawed, just for lack of a better word.
Not only flawed, but like, come on, y'all. Like, just bad. It's. I mean, inhuman.
Yes.
Their viewpoint is inhuman. They are still human. So I do think that it's hard for me to hear from people, which I have a lot, actually, that my viewpoints are extreme or radical, because I think it's actually very natural. That's how I felt my whole life, you know, as a kid, you know, as a teenager, as an adult. I think that to promote anything else is sort of just sad. It's just sad to see people who want to exclude those who already don't have rights. So I do think, in terms of how to sort of move on with that, I think for me, it's just about focusing on the idea that there are a lot of people doing the right thing. There are a lot of people who believe the right thing. And there are a lot of people, too, who, like, think they believe that all people are not equal. But when you actually get right down to it and start questioning them on why they can't articulate it, it also really helps me to unplug and, like, not look at all that news we were just talking about, like, not look at the policies that our current administration is putting out there, because it makes me really sad. It makes me really get down in the dumps. And so I think on one level, you have to stay aware of what's going on in the world. But for me, unplugging is a huge part of how I'm able to continue to do my work, is because I just plug in less frequently. You know, I just get all my bad news at once, deal with it all at once, and then wait a little while before I check back in. Yeah, I think it is a struggle. It is hard to try and persevere in this kind of work, because it's not easy. It's not easy to keep that optimism and hope alive, because the world doesn't change that fast. That's a big thing that I've learned, particularly coming back to an institution later in my life, you know, in grad school. A big, big lesson that I've learned is that institutional change is so slow. It's so slow. And patience is really, it's really hard to be patient. And it is something that I struggle with, for sure.
This is Hereabouts. On this episode, we have Kayla Mation-Garvin, feminist and playwright, who is currently speaking about her work and how she integrates the theme of feminism into her plays. It's so interesting when you say those who would for lack of a better word, attack on these views and call them radical or extreme. And when questioned, they can't articulate their thoughts well enough. But here you are, you're articulating your views, your opinions so well, might I add. And I think there's this beautiful irony in that. But it's also interesting to hear your process on the matter and how you take in this news. And you unplug, and then you process. And would you say it's all part of the creative process and how you integrate and how you use your work as a platform to show what your views are and to promote feminism? And I would also like to know if it's an example of this in which you do promote your views, and what do you want the audience to take away from seeing one of your plays?
Yeah, totally. I mean, okay, so I talked a little about my play House of Mirth, which is currently running. It'll close tomorrow, actually. And another work that I've written that sort of relates to this is a play called High School Coven. And it's a play set in a high school where it's about four teenage witches. And, you know, it's a comedy. They go shopping. They, like, are witches together. But they also are dealing with the issue of reporting sexual assault within the educational institution. Yeah. And so I think both in High School Coven and in House of Mirth, for me, I was just listening to this interview by this playwright, Paula Vogel, who's one of the great sort of like modern American masters of playwriting. And she was saying, you know, you can do as much research as you want. You can think beforehand through the politics of your play. But at some point, you just have to put that away and write what you're going to write. And if you're a political person, it's going to come out in your work. And if you're not, it's not. And you shouldn't try to enforce that on your work. And I do think, I actually don't know that I really think of myself as that much of a political person. But it so happens that each time when I put my research down to work on a play, it ends up being more or less political. And I do think that like most art, all art, question mark? No, period. All art is political in some way or shape or form. I think the act of making art as a person of color, as a queer person of color, is a political act. But I do think my plays happen to be political because I feel like as a queer person of color moving through the world, you can't help but be political because, you know, we're talking about a world in which we're not always welcome, you know, and not always encouraged to. We don't necessarily have the same right to tell our stories as everybody else. So I think that my work is often political because I'm combating that, as well as saying whatever I want to say about how our educational system does not allow for people to be survivors and succeed as well as it could.
Yeah. What do you want your audience to take away from seeing one of your plays?
Hopefully, I mean, with the two works I just mentioned, High School Coven and House of Mirth, it's kind of difficult because there's a difference between my ideal audience and the audience that I know that I'm going to have. I create work for people like myself. Like, I feel like I write for queer people of color. But the audience is usually not that, especially here in Indiana. We have a beautiful, wonderful subscriber base at the theater here on campus. And they're so supportive of all our new work, but they are not the demographic that I'm necessarily writing for. They're sort of just an older demographic than I am used to talking to. So it's interesting to have written this work that is ideally for, you know, queer people of color being consumed by a larger audience, a larger, you know, a student body that is generally not queer people of color, and a super supportive subscriber base who is also not queer people of color by and large. Because I feel like I do have a responsibility to talk to them too. There's a difference, I think, in talking to those different audiences because for my demographic, for queer people of color, I sort of want to, you know, I want to address the issues that we face, but I also want to sort of impart a sense of hope, like a deep sense of hope and optimism, because I feel like that's something that's hard to manufacture, and it's something that we are all trying to shore up. And on the other hand, I feel like I do want to talk to a white audience, because I feel like we have to be inclusive in how we go about making change. And if we do want to effect real substantive change within our lifetimes, we sort of, you know, all people are necessary, including and especially white people. And so it's important to me that I not leave them behind, but I don't know how well I'm doing it, you know. For me, when I'm talking to the audience who's not my demographic, I really want I guess I want to hold a mirror up to what's going on, and I want to just sort of try and see if through drama and through theater I can sort of show people, like, hey, this is a lived experience that's different from your own. Hey, this is what I go through. Hey, this is what my friends go through. Hey, this is, you know, what we're up against. And this is, these are the ways in which you're perpetuating that. But also in a kind way, like, I do think, you know, I don't want to lose people. And I do think that they, everyone has something to contribute to the movement if they decide that they want to be in on it.
Yeah, I think that was beautiful to hear. I'm not even exaggerating. That was so powerful, what you just said. And your sense of purpose to instill a sense of hope into like-minded individuals, and to not only do that, but to also empathize with them and show that they're not alone is so powerful. But at the same time, you mentioned not having the audience that comes to your plays. They're not who you anticipate seeing, and still you're able to promote your values and you're able to spread that awareness. And whether they're an older demographic or not, I think everyone has some influence, and once they are able to process your art, they see this, and maybe we can only hope that they take away from that and talk about and spark conversation.
Hopefully, yeah. If they don't hate it, hopefully they're even if they do hate it, hopefully at least if they see it, they're talking about it, you know? That's the hope anyway.
Yeah. As we're wrapping up, I just wanted to ask if there was anything that we might have missed, or that we would like to add to the topic, or your work that you would like to mention.
No, I feel like this was pretty far-reaching. Yeah, this is cool.
You are listening to Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio. On this episode, we had Kayla Mation Garvin, playwright and feminist, who was speaking about her work and how she integrates feminism into her plays. I'm Joyce Lamb.
I'm Kayla Mation Garvin.
And join us on our next episode, where we speak on AAPI Heritage Month.
Been listening to Hereabouts.
Hereabouts is produced with the IU Asian Culture Center and broadcast from WFHB in Bloomington. Our theme music is by Eternal Youth.
Tune in to Hereabouts every other week from 5:30 to 6 on Wednesdays right here on WFHB.